Hello and welcome to the fifth night of Millennial 2020. Hello. And I'll just mute welcome. All the other the windows that are coming up here. Right. So, hello and welcome to the fifth night of Millennial 2020. And I should first say that just to explain the t-shirts, what's going on with all this damn notifications? I do apologize. Okay, so I'll just explain the t-shirt for tonight. This is a rather cool Doctor Who themed t-shirt that, very nice. Again, red bubble. They're probably going to sue me. It wouldn't surprise me if I keep going on about that. But anyway, cool t-shirts. All right. And now, my guest tonight, first of all, well, we've got Josh Neal coming up, and then E. Michael Jones, and then Robin Riley. But the first one is Dr. Greg Johnson, founder of Countercurrents. I think most people will be familiar with him. Needs no introduction, really. But Greg, welcome to Millennial 2020, and thank you for taking part.
Well, thank you. Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you. So we're going to discuss, you're going to just give your impressions of the year 2020, and then we'll be taking questions later on. And the URL for questions is, as usual, on Entropy. I'll just share it on the D-line. I should say this isn't going out on YouTube because we weren't sure if we might go into territory that's not YouTube-friendly. It's becoming very restrictive. I won't moan about it. Just everyone knows the situation. So, okay. The URL for questions is here. All right. Okay, someone says, for the love of God, Millennial, will stop talking about your t-shirts. I do apologize. All right, so Greg, go ahead with what you would say about 2020. Obviously, I would say that there are three things defining this year. COVID and the lockdown and the Great Reset, BLM and the US election. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that 2020 is going to be looked upon by future historians as maybe the year that America died, the year that America finally passed its peak and started irrevocably declining. And whoever is sworn in as president next month is going to inherit the worst mess of any president in American history. We have an epidemic, a pandemic. We've got the economic consequences of this pandemic. We have the economic consequences of the Black Lives Matter and Antifa insurrection that's been going on since May. And we have the continuation of this civil unrest. On top of that, there's a legitimacy crisis that the next president faces. No matter who's sworn in as president in January, the other half of the country is basically going to reject that person as illegitimate. So it's a very, very difficult position for any president to negotiate, much less somebody who's senile and in his depends years as Joe Biden is. So
I probably well that's almost the least of his problems in a way, because he's also corrupt and probably a pedophile. I mean, it's a very strange choice for them to put up.
Well, it's a very cynical choice. I really do believe that the people running the Democratic Party, whoever they are so cynical, and they were so arrogant that they believed that their friends in the press and their friends in academia and their friends in the deep state could make Donald Trump so radioactive that the Democrats could put up a dead dog and get that piece of roadkill elected. And so, just maybe to test out the thing, they put up a candidate who practically is dead, nearly dead and certainly doddering. And they thought that he would win handily.
Yeah. If I could just intervene, it's interesting how they do this. They don't do a small trick or a small manipulation. They do a huge one. Remember when Trayvon Martin was not an innocent, sweet, good-natured black boy. He was a thug, And there are photos of him with, you know, guns and the gold teeth and all that. And obviously, look, just awful. And then the same with Michael Brown. And then the same with George Floyd. You know, they choose to lionize people who are obviously scum.
They don't have any choice. I don't think there are any black criminals who are, you know, gunned down by cops who aren't complete scum. And they're so cynical, they think they can basically burnish up these turds and make them into heroes. And
they can, though. That's the thing.
They can. That's the trouble. That's the trouble. George Floyd's face is everywhere now. He had how many funerals in a golden casket, and he was a complete piece of shit. He was not an admirable person at all, and the world's better off without him, to be perfectly honest. But you can't say that. They've created this hysteria, this cult around this worthless piece of crap. Breonna Taylor, another piece of shit. All of these people who have died recently, all these BLM martyrs are complete garbage as human beings. And it doesn't matter to black people, apparently, and it doesn't matter to the media and the people who uncritically consume media content. Well, it doesn't matter to them either, sadly. It's almost, I think some of these people are just laughing. You know, they think, what human detritus can we burnish up into a hero today? And they laugh at these people who just eagerly lap this up and believe their bullshit.
Yeah. I think you have to separate the at least two echelons within the mainstream media. I think there is the top tier who I think know exactly what they're doing. And then there's the, you know, the probably a huge, very thick layer of what we would call SJWs, who are genuinely they're white people who think that they're being good, think that they're doing the right thing. I'm sure
is the operative word here. Yeah,
well, not that bright, indeed. I mean, and you can talk to reporters and journalists. No doubt, you've had much more experience of that than I have, and it's clear that they're not very bright. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing I would emphasize here is that they probably do believe they're doing the right thing. They're probably very ideological, very morally driven, I think, to paint this extremely. I mean, I think that there are probably, and I've got my image, the image in my mind is obviously of a young female journalist, which might be a bit sexist of me, but I don't think so. I think it's very accurate. Who probably genuinely believes that George Floyd was a great guy and that Trayvon Martin was just an innocent kid. And Michael Brown was a gentle giant. And somehow, it doesn't matter what else comes in to contradict that. They find some way, as they always do, to just maintain that illusion, because their status as a good person depends on them believing this stuff. Actually, that reminds me of something I just read today, just a brief, very brief digression. Your credit, I don't know if this is on Gizmodo, your credit score should be based on your web history, IMF says. Now, and that, I think that's the sort of extension of this, where your beliefs do dictate, are you a good person or not? Well, what do you believe? What are your beliefs about the world? Do you believe that Trayvon Martin was a thug? Or do you believe that he was an angel? Because this is going to affect your credit score. I mean, I don't find this a surprising development. I mean, it's just hypothetical, it's perspective just now, but I find it very plausible.
Yeah, well, we have a social credit system that's being implemented piecemeal by private organizations in the West. That's far more invasive in the end than the Chinese social credit system, and it's far more socially dysfunctional. Say what you like about the Chinese. What are the Chinese trying to do with their social credit system? They're trying to make a high trust society, in a way. They're trying to penalize people for basically being bad citizens. And it's not just censoring their beliefs. Whereas in the West, you can be utter human garbage, like these pedophiles and drug addicts in Antifa. But as long as you have the quote-unquote right views, you're considered a good citizen. You're a model citizen. People like George Floyd are model citizens by these people's standards. And, well, you can't have a society built on quote-unquote model citizens like that. Years ago, somebody a very clever fellow, I forget his name actually, did a little thought experiment. He said, imagine if on election day in America, everybody who pulled the Democrat lever died instantly. Well, the next day, the country would wake up and be able to go on pretty much, you know, there'd be a period of mourning, but the civilization would not collapse because a civilization can get along without the George Floyds and the Antifa and the cat ladies and the other typical Democrat voters, right? We can get along without those people. You can't get along without the typical Republican voters. If every Republican dropped dead on election day, basically you could color America gone. The people who actually make society work tend to be in the red voter category. And the people who are parasites and creators of chaos and so forth tend to be in the blue category. And I think we have a social credit system. Well, I mean, the entire left in the West is based on an inverted moral hierarchy. You are a better person if you're more marginal and more victimized and have more problems. Well, if you actually took that seriously, if you tried to create a society based simply on those negative characteristics, it would simply not work. And so what they are is they're parasites.
No, by design.
Yeah, they're parasites. These people are parasites on the virtues of people they despise, on the work of people they despise, on the accumulated social capital of people they despise and that they're trying to destroy. And when they get their way finally, they'll just perish in the end because you can't have a society that consists entirely of misfits, basically.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that's we were discussing the mainstream media, and I said that there, I think, you know, the bulk of it is white European people trying to be good people and obsessed with virtue and all that, and probably quite frantic. I've always got this image in my head from, I remember talking about it in my first ever speech, so in Rotterdam in 2016. So I know that it's not recent. It's been around for a long time. And it was that image of some woman somewhere in America. And she's like this. So she's like that, about to unload on someone who's disagreeing with her. People will remember it. And if you saw it, you would know it instantly. But that, for me, remains my sort of mental image of the SJW, which, and I know that that's a bit of an antiquated category at this point, but I think it's still very relevant. I mean, they're not all Antifa yet. There's still droves of them who are this sort of gender-fluid, binary, non-binary bedroom feminist type. It's still a thing. And that's still my mental image of it. I know it's not... it's not strictly speaking a white creation, but it is a white manifest. It's a white phenomenon. So I think it's a way to, you've sort of set somebody up to on a course where they've got to try to be a good person, but reality is going to be constantly avalanching down upon them. And they're going to be constantly confused about that. And so they're going to be demented. Greg, are you there?
Yeah. I don't know what to say. I'm sorry. I don't know what more to say about this particular topic. But we do have definitely an inverted moral system that is being pushed by the left. It's been pushed by the left, and it's equivalents for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And the ability of these people to push this with all the sneaky technologies that are now available today, including the little machines that spy on us in our bedrooms and that we carry in our pockets that spy on us and spy on our every preference, our every phone call, our every text message, and so forth. It's a rather terrifying prospect. Honestly, the Chinese social credit system is healthier and more responsible. Yeah, It really is. And yet,
yeah, Morgoth did a really good, I think he did a Telegram post about this. I can't remember whether he made it into a video afterwards, but he made this point that at least, you know, the Chinese social credit system is sinister and overbearing and all that, but at least it's actually heading towards it's designed to build a good society. It's designed to result in a good society. Our equivalent of it is designed to destroy us.
Yeah. Yeah, if you follow these particular values, you will be destroyed.
Yes. So that we got onto this because we were talking about the media and how they tweet. So we were talking about Biden.
Yeah.
So that brings us back to Biden. Is there any more that you'd like to say about that? I'll read out something that I put off on Telegram back at the time, and. Yeah, this was just a day or two before the election, and I said, if Biden wins, it will be the worst possible indictment of the modern mainstream media. I mean, he's a senile and corrupt paedophile crook with a corrupt paedophile crook son who's also a junkie. I don't know how much worse it could be. Now, I don't want to be reveling in the decline, but sometimes you do have to laugh at how farcical and bizarre and surreal the situation is. So we were talking about how the media have somehow managed, and I think it is quite genuine that I mean, they spent 4 years demonizing Trump. They spent 4 years pretending that every tiny little thing that he did was the end of America as we know it, and a harbinger of a new fascist, racist age, when he did almost nothing. I mean, that's, I suppose, what would you say about Trump's presidency? We've had this for 4 years. What would you say has been achieved? I mean, obviously, there's the Tel Aviv thing. Not much.
Well, else. Yeah. Trump didn't accomplish a whole lot as president. That isn't to say that he accomplished nothing. He did make some progress on border security. The wall... To me, I think was a dangerous proposal because it became symbolic. It sort of concentrated every proposal into one concrete image, right? The wall. How much wall has been built today? Ann Coulter would keep tweeting, you know. But he did do a lot of things short of building a wall across the entire southern border that lowered immigration, which is good because anything that slows white demographic decline down, gives us time for political organizing. So I think he did good things in that area. He didn't do enough. He didn't do anywhere near as much as we had hoped, but he did do some good things. So I think that, and the other thing is, we have to ask, even if Trump had done nothing, Trump was not Hillary Clinton. Trump kept Hillary Clinton out of office. What would Hillary Clinton have accomplished in the last 4 years if Trump hadn't kept her out of office? So that is a factor that we have to take into account as well. Simply by not being Hillary Clinton, Trump did this country a giant favor. And then on top of that, he did us important favors by slowing down white demographic decline. The most important thing he did before he even got elected, before he even got the nomination, which is simply break this gentleman's agreement in the GOP that we're not going to compete on trade and immigration anymore. We're not going to challenge globalization. He broke that gentleman's agreement. And that was an important thing because now those issues are not going to go quietly away. People want populism. They want nationalism. They want protectionism. They want industrial policy. They want American manufacturing jobs back. And that appetite has been whetted by Trump. Whether or not he satisfied it or not is another question. But people want that. People aren't going to be shut up about that. And I think that is going to change politics in the future in the post-Trump era. Now, I don't color him out just yet. I think it would be a miracle if he got sworn in as president again. I think he probably has been cheated out of re-election. But to actually get him in the White House again would depend on the honor and courage of countless Republicans. And there's not that many Republicans with any honor or courage. And so I think that he has a very, very low chance of actually being put back in office, which is what he really deserves.
A question that occurs is, you say that he whetted the appetite in Americans for, to care about jobs, things like that. Would you say that he's paving the way for a kind of, I don't want to say, a type of nationalism and protectionism, where I think that America, up until Trump, I don't know the economic history in any detail of America, but it seems to me that America prior to Trump, it was always the economy really is the only, we're free marketeers, we believe in free trade, we believe in commerce, we believe in capitalism. And that's really the only thing. And as long as, I'm thinking about Reagan, as long as people, and Thatcher over here, as long as people have access to the ability to make money, then if they don't make money, fuck them, kind of thing. And I think that as capitalism has become ever more efficient and effective, that worldview has come to seem, just one-eyed, because what you end up with is massive corporations offshoring jobs to China or wherever, and then the local working class in your own country, and indeed increasingly the middle class, are left jobless. So it's an unrealistic worldview, because what it leads to is mass destitution, and then the dreadful cultural effects that follow that, nihilism, drug abuse, of course, and broken families. So in other words, you can't make money your God, but I think America, for at least for a long time, did make money its God. What would you say about that? I mean, if I'm being dreadfully simplistic, I might well have imbibed a lot of anti-American sentiment when I was growing up, so forgive me, but what do you think?
Well, I think you're essentially right about that. And America has pursued globalization and devil take the hindmost capitalism for a very long time. And we're seeing the consequences of that. It really, really got going in the 1990s. And before that, we did have certain barriers to this. That we had strong unions and things like that. But really, starting in the 1970s, the power of labor unions declined. We got this neoliberal consensus, which was basically capital's voice became stronger and stronger. And the result has been, very predictable. Basic microeconomics, the stuff you would learn. Look, you could take the first month of a basic economics class and then drop out, and you would know the effect of a single global market for any product, including labor. And that is a single global price, which means that first world workers will become pauperized by globalization of labor, either by importing cheap labor or by sending jobs overseas. The net result will be that Western workers will become pauperized, and workers in the third world will get a little bit more money, because there's a whole lot more of them than there are of us. That's predictable. Everybody knows that. It's never been put to a vote, because the workers in the West would never vote to pauperize themselves. But that's what's going on. And we simply have to call a halt to this reckless globalization. We need protectionism. We need to basically say, we will not allow cheap labor to come in and undermine our workers, and we will not offshore our industries. And if somebody wants to offshore their industry, if somebody wants to send their factory to China, fine, let the Chinese buy their products. We won't take their products, right? We will put such high tariffs on their products that they won't be tempted to leave the country. That's how we do this. We have to basically make sure that the white countries of the world maintain their high-paying industrial jobs. And to do that, we have to say no to capitalists We have to say no to open borders, and we have to say no to offshoring industries and importing the products of cheap labor from around the world. It's very simple economics. America, throughout most of its history, was a tariff society, a protectionist society. And the federal government was primarily funded by tariffs. And during that time, we became an industrial powerhouse. And since we have adopted free trade, we have become a deindustrialized society where our basic economic profile is that of a third world colony combined with, say, Wall Street. You know, that's what we are now. We're basically a colony of international capital. And the results for the working and middle classes are totally predictable, and they're utterly catastrophic. That's why populism is on the rise in America, and that's why it's on the rise in Europe, to stop that.
Would you say that this occurred after World War II? I mean, you said it sort of really got into gear in the 90s. When would you say it actually began? Because America in the 50s is, you know, is spoken about now as an industrial powerhouse.
Well, yeah, the United States was producing quite a lot of stuff, especially after the Second World War, when Europe and Japan were in ruins. What happened, though, is it really started, okay, up until the 1960s, the American economy was doing fantastically well, and American workers were doing fantastically well. It was really during the early 70s that the working class started losing ground in America. And there were a number of factors that contributed to that. But by the end of the 1970s, basically the pro-worker consensus in government was replaced by the pro-capitalist consensus. This is when we got Margaret Thatcher. This is when we got Ronald Reagan. People had this, we had this phenomenon of stagflation in the 1970s. People thought, oh, this is a problem caused by labor unions and things like that. Certainly in the UK, the unions were behaving very, very irresponsibly. And we started electing these strike breakers, basically. In America, it was Reagan and Thatcher. They were the beginning of this turn towards neoliberal capitalism. And part of that ideology is open borders and open markets. And that slowly began to be implemented more and more throughout the 1990s. And it was implemented by people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, too, because the center left became enamored of these market-friendly pro-globalization policies as well.
I think that the left, I think honestly that in Britain at least, the people who were ostensibly socialists, Labour became New Labour, because those people, I think, always had a disdain for the working class. And their idea was that, well, you don't need to remain working class. You don't need to work in the mines like your dad did and your grandfather did. You can get a job, a more middle class job in a call centre or something. Something more educated, something more professional. But the fact is, a lot of people can't do that. So you're setting them up for failure. But also, these jobs are of a different ilk. They don't reward in the same way that, and I'm saying this as someone who's never worked down a mine, I acknowledge that, but I don't think they do reward in the same way that those old job industrial jobs did. I know a family who, they always worked in the mines, and then now the two sons are in their late 30s now. They're the youngest generation, and they don't do manual jobs. They don't have what their forefathers did have. Now, I'm not saying that we should artificially elongate these kinds of jobs. I'm saying that something has been lost, and just on that level, the sort of working class masculinity no longer has a way to express itself. And you saw that even in something like Fight Club 20 years ago, that they have to create that, a Fight Club, because it's the modern world is too suffocating And it doesn't allow, and this also, it's not just a class thing. I think it affects men everywhere. It does not allow the expression of masculinity, but it's also very averse to that. I mean, you see this in corporations where they have now become remodeled so that they are frankly more amenable to women, which again, it thwarts that more professional type of masculinity. I mean, you see this everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. The left stopped being about the working class, and it stopped being about equality. And instead became a way that people who are basically college-educated scribes, people who write, people with college degrees, it became their way of battering their way in or climbing the greasy pole in corporations and NGOs, by claiming that they are marginalized people who need special privileges and a leg up. And so the left became all about people with high verbal IQs and college degrees getting ahead within capitalism by claiming to be marginalized and outsiders. And that's a world apart from the old left of trying to take care of the working class. And the values of this new left are completely opposed to working class values. Working class people tend to be socially conservative. The new left tend to be complete lunatics today. I mean, it's Tumblrite identity politics and political correctness.
That's complete insanity.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's complete insanity. But to get this back on track towards Trump, if that's why the left became enamored of capitalism and that's how they became globalistic, how did the right become globalistic? How did it become enamored of identity politics or the left or whatever you want to call it, progressivism?
Well, how did progressivism become enamored of identity politics?
No, the right.
Okay, well... Capitalism, okay, the free market capitalist mentality, free market liberalism, it's an inherently universalistic doctrine. It always has been. It's always been about the rights of man, not the rights of Englishman, not the rights of Frenchman, but the rights of man. And the marketplace is a universal phenomenon, right? There's no principle that would limit the marketplace's extension to the entire globe, except for the interference of politics. If you just leave people free to trade, you will have a global marketplace and a global price for every commodity, including labor. That's just built into their ideology from the start. They're individualists, not collectivists. So it doesn't matter to them if this has consequences for historically existing communities and nations. Those things aren't real to them. Society doesn't exist, as Margaret Thatcher said, right? Collectives don't exist. It's only individuals and their interactions. And individuals with their interactions satisfying their given preferences don't care about history and culture and borders and things like that. If you can get things at a cheaper price by buying from your historical enemy across the border next door, capitalists will be the first people to do that. And they think that this is going to lead to a global utopia where there's no more war and no more conflict, no more prejudice and things like that. Everybody's just going to be peacefully trading with one another and satisfying their individual preferences.
It's quite strange to think that the right believe that there'll be no war because we'll all be hopelessly entwined economically. And the left believe there'll be no more war because we'll all be hopelessly entwined genetically with each other.
Yeah. Whatever happened to diversity, right?
Yeah. I think they're on course to abandoning that. Yeah. And because it's too problem. It's too difficult. It's too annoying. They'll go for equality.
Right. Now, the reason why the left has gone for identity politics, or the Tumblrite variety, is this. The left, at core, is a Jewish movement. Marxism was a Jewish movement, and it battened on to socialism and the workers and things like that for a while as its vehicle, its chosen vehicle. But by the early 20th century, especially by the 1920s and 1930s, it became apparent to Jews that the working class was not necessarily their friends. When you had fascism and national socialism, and then you had Stalinism, which frightened them as well, they decided we need a new left. They wanted a new vehicle. And so Western Marxists, especially the Frankfurt School and other non-Soviet Marxists, started looking around for a different vehicle. And that different vehicle became basically organizing non-whites, subaltern colonial peoples, minorities within white societies, and disaffected groups, outsider groups, into this sort of bio-Leninist coalition to overthrow capitalism. And all of this talk about the other and the marginalized, all of these policies that promote the upward mobility of marginalized outsiders, all of those are really proxies for Jews. They're battering rams for Jews. That politics was pioneered by Jews who were trying to gain upward mobility within societies that formerly excluded them. And so that's really the reason why the left moved away from the workers. The workers were never really what the left was about.
Yes, I think it's one of those, it's a cope of civic nationalists and so on to think that the left abandoned the working class because they didn't join the communist revolution. I think that's not quite the case. No doubt it was a motivating factor, but I think the main thing is that the left as such never cared about the working class in the first place and just decided they needed a different battering ram.
Yeah, exactly. It was a change in tactics, basically, and a change in the people that they try and ride on. Basically, it was moving to a new host, if you will.
Yeah. So if that we've talked about the left and the right. So that brings us to Trump, and we've already talked about this, but let's just sort of nail it down. What do you think that Trump represented for America in 2016, and what is it that he has whetted?
Well, he was talking about bringing jobs back to America. He was talking about immigration control. These are things that Americans, especially working Americans, want. They don't want foreign competition. They don't want their jobs going overseas. They don't want cheap scab labor coming in and ruining their lives and their communities. That's what he was promising. And that was a solid red meat populist agenda. And it was very, very popular. That's what got him elected. Once he got into office, well, he found himself surrounded by Republicans. Most of the people around Trump didn't believe in his own vision. And Trump himself had a kind of tenuous grasp of what he was doing, I think. The guy's not stupid. In fact, I think he's considerably intelligent, but he's not an intellectual. And he doesn't think in terms of principles. And so I think he just found it very, very easy to get bamboozled by these people. And so very, very quickly, the impetus was for a lot of his policies was just sort of blunted, or he lost a lot of momentum very, very quickly. So we got a lot of Republican policies out of Trump. Why? Well, because it's easy to give the Republicans what they want when they have the majority in the House and Senate. We got a lot of pro-Zionist policies out of Trump. Why? Because it's always easy to give Jews what they want. Somehow you can always do that. Somehow there's just no real opposition to it. It all melts away like butter. So that's just the reality of the situation. But when he wanted to do the stuff that the people wanted, well, suddenly that became very, very difficult, to impossible. Why? Well, the entire establishment was against him, including people in his own administration, in his own party, in the deep state, in the bureaucracy, let's just call it the bureaucracy, they were against this. And so he was being sabotaged left and right. And that's just the sad story of his administration. So I think that he still accomplished some things that are of value, and we're going to miss him terribly if Biden gets in. We're going to see what would have happened if we had 4 years of Hillary Clinton, right? It would have been a whole lot worse, and it's going to get a whole lot worse if Trump is out of office, which isn't to say that Trump accomplished a lot, but he did accomplish. The one great thing that he accomplished was not being Hillary Clinton. If he's reelected, if he takes the office again, the greatest thing that he will accomplish is not being Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I mean, I hate to put it in such negative terms, but that is a real achievement in a way. Just not being these crazy, horrible people is a good feature about him. And a lot of people probably voted for him simply for that reason. It wasn't so much a vote for him as against them.
If I could just intervene, I think this all shows the limits of pragmatism, because if you are, and I think pragmatism is something that conservatives have always admired, definitely in Britain. We just want a guy who gets the job done. We just want a guy who believes in real things, practicalities, not someone whose head is full of ideas and principles and wacko, airy-fairy stuff. But unfortunately, when you get a guy in who's like that, such as Trump, as you say, he's very easily bamboozled and drawn off course by people who do have ideas and principles and values and are willing to defend them at almost any cost. And then, because then they'll make it that the pragmatic thing for him to do is whatever they want him to do. And I think that this shows a sort of baffled conservative, and I think he is a conservative. A baffled conservative just led by the nose by the people around him who actually do have ideas and visions for society, whereas he didn't really. He just wanted things to be good again. He wanted to make America great again, but I don't think he really knew what that meant, what he meant by it, not in clear terms anyway. He was a pragmatist, and he was a pragmatist defeated by people who were also pragmatists, but also had a vision. I think this really shows the limits of what happens with conservatives, because they simply don't have any vision.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, I'm sorry that I interrupted you when you were...
Oh, no, no, I agree with that. So I think we basically... I've said my piece about Donald Trump. I hope he does get back in the White House. I think he clearly deserved it. I think he's clearly been robbed. I have absolutely no doubt that there's been massive election fraud, and it's a shame. It's what you expect, though, in America today. America is a profoundly sick and corrupt society, and there just aren't enough Americans of good character to turn it around. That's my great fear.
I mean, I remember you and I met in America 4 years ago when I was there for what was called the Dangerous Haggis Tour. That was a play on Milo's thing, the Dangerous Faggot Tour. Anyway, it doesn't matter now. But you and I met, and at that point you were quite optimistic that this was going to be a renaissance of American society. And it is a shame that that has not come to pass. But as you say, he has at least not been Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. So let's, I suppose, go into what you think. I mean, let's assume that he's not going to be the president and Joe Biden is going to be the president. What are your predictions for that? Given, the salient thing for me, the sort of defining thing for me about Joe Biden is that awful clip where he celebrates that white Americans are going to be a minority. And he says that that's a good thing. It's horrendous. But of course, he's bad enough, but he's probably not going to last the full term, and he'll be replaced by Kamala Harris. So, well, what are your thoughts on what we could be facing over the next 4 years?
Well, I mean, I don't have anything especially insightful to say about this. Just more horrors, more bad decisions, more bad policies, more riots, more lies, more open borders, and so on and so forth, and more of an assault on white people in America, more of an assault on white people in Europe, and so forth. It's a shame that this has happened. It's a shame that our best hope in America was Donald Trump. He wasn't very good, really, when you get down to it. I know that there's this cult of personality around the guy, but objectively, he didn't accomplish all that much. And beyond that, he could have done so much more. If he were only more articulate, these ridiculous press conferences when the George Floyd thing happened, why didn't he just go out there and say, look, the fact is that black people are not being gunned down indiscriminately by the cops. It's just not true. It's just not true. The idea that the police are an especial danger to black people is false. In fact, it's just the reverse. Black people are extremely dangerous to the police. Black people are extremely dangerous to white people in general. It's not the reverse. These are basic facts. I mean, if we had a courageous, articulate president, he would have said some of this stuff. But no, he was out there, honor his name. It was so weak and so pathetic. But we just didn't have an articulate spokesman who was willing to stand up for even basic truths about crime and police brutality and police killings and things like that. And because of that, we've had months and months of violence in the United States. Now, telling the truth wouldn't necessarily have stopped it, but it certainly would have emboldened a lot of people not to go along with this. There was a kind of hysteria in America. And if a few prominent people had stood up against it and said, it's all based on a lie, George Floyd wasn't murdered. There isn't an epidemic of police brutality against blacks. Black lives matter quite a lot, actually, to white people, actually more than they matter to black people. These are a few truths that would have been extremely helpful. And if the president had stood up against this stupid hysteria, it could have changed everything. There were so many opportunities that he had to stand up and simply speak the truth and hold his ground, and he didn't do it. He did the chicken shit Republican stuff, which is basically to try and get their policy preferences without challenging the whole anti-white narrative, the whole normative fake morality that we've got, which is that identity politics is okay for everybody except white people. Racism is okay for everybody except for white people. If white people benefit from it, then it's intolerable. They're such cowards that they would not challenge this stupid dogma. But that is the stupid dogma that's destroying America. That's the stupid dogma that prevents people from defending themselves against raging mobs of black criminals and Antifa scum who are out there under false pretenses. But we just didn't have that guy. And it's a real shame because so much depends on simply stopping these crazed evil policies. He could have done so much more, but he didn't. He didn't have it in him. I don't think he had the character. I don't think he had the knowledge. And I think he was basically hamstrung by believing this anti-white moral dogma that's basically suffocating America and every white country around the world.
As you say, it's so disappointing because he was the one man in the entire world who could have done these things, who could have gone up against the American mainstream media and won, and who could have gone up against Silicon Valley and won. He was the one man who could have done it, and possibly the last man who could have done it, historically.
Yeah, it's just a terrible, terrible missed opportunity.
Terrible missed opportunity. Would you like to say anything about the generational thing? Because it seems to me that, and this has come up with several other, especially the Blackpilled stream, which was also only on DLive, but you can now see it on BitChute. It does seem to me that there's a generational problem here as well, because I think that just on the social media thing, the Silicon Valley, I think that boomer conservatives absolutely don't understand the problem with censorship on the internet. I think that they might, it's possible that they're now starting to grasp it 4 years too late, but they definitely haven't grasped it. As I said to Black Pill, there was a congressional hearing with some people from Silicon Valley, like head honchos, and the Republicans who should have been there saying, holding these people's feet to the fire and saying, why aren't you abiding by the First Amendment? They were instead saying, what are you doing to combat hate speech on your platform? It was as if they had no idea what they were there to do, what their job was. Because, of course, what they ended up doing was essentially doing their enemies' work for them and establishing that, well, of course, they're, obviously, we all know, we all agree that there should be hate speech protections on Twitter and on YouTube and on Facebook and Instagram, and you should be banning conservatives and you should be banning right-wingers and you should be banning nationalists. So why aren't you doing more of that? Essentially, they'd been trained to castrate themselves, and they didn't even know it. And I think this is astounding. Someone did say to me that there was an issue of that something in the American political system means that it favors old men, and by the time so in this age, by the time old men get to power, the technology has gone on leaps and bounds from when they were in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and they don't understand it. And that was never a problem, really, until now, when social media and technology is so decisive in everyday life. So you've got these Republicans who simply don't understand what they're doing. Would you like to speak about that?
Well, I agree with you, basically. That was a huge missed opportunity. I don't know if it's generational or not. I'm sure part of it's that. Part of it is just the stupid free market liberal dogmas that cripple the minds of most Republicans, most conservatives. They think that, well, this is a private company. They don't have to abide by the First Amendment. They think that it would probably be perfectly fine for the phone company to cut you off in mid-conversation if somebody at the phone company didn't like what you were saying. They think it would be perfectly fine for the gas company to cut you off and let you freeze in the dark because they don't like your politics. We don't allow this to happen because a lot of laws in America were passed by people who weren't crippled by this libertarian imbecility. Right, we have laws on the books governing earlier forms of giant corporations and giant monopolies like power companies and phone companies, because those laws were made by people who recognized that corporations abuse people all the time if they're not regulated. And now we have a post 1970s free market Koch brothers, Milton Friedman consensus on the leadership of the right. It's a very unpopular ideology amongst mainstream Republicans. More than 70% of mainstream Republicans do not want to see any cuts to Social Security and other entitlement programs. It's very unpopular. The kind of stuff that Paul Ryan believes is very unpopular, even among Republicans. And yet that is the mentality of practically everybody in the Congress today who's a Republican. And all the people they listen to, all of the lobby groups, all of the think tanks, they believe this nonsense. So they think that it's perfectly fine for these massive corporations, these new monopolies that have come along, to abuse the public and engage in blatant censorship. And it's just a limitation of their ideology. Their ideology is incredibly stupid. And we need to go back to a more intelligent right that recognizes that there's a legitimate role for government power in regulating the marketplace, especially monopolies like this. They are simply so stupid that they will be, if they follow their principles, they will cease to exist as a political party. Unfortunately, we're depending on these fools to stop other things that are even more serious, like white genocide, basically. It's not what they want to do, of course. They're all for open borders, but we need some kind of rightist opposition, right? And it's the Republicans are the only sorry thing that we got to work with in the United States. And then the odd populist fluke like Donald Trump.
So would you say anything about this theory that I encountered that the American political system favors older men?
Well, yeah, every political system, I think, favors older men. Yeah, it's just true. And as long as people are going to continue living longer, there's going to be an increasing tendency towards gerontocracy. And the trouble is that people's basic mental map of the world is pretty much fossilized by the time they get 30. And so people who were 30, 40 years ago, their mentalities are simply not based on anything. Their mentalities are not up to the challenge of what's going on today.
I agree. And I think you see that. I mean, this is the root of the boomer memes. You know, it's not that people have just chosen arbitrarily to dislike boomers. And I remember, you know,
I'm really sick of all these boomer memes, to be perfectly honest.
I don't want to be horrible to them. I don't want to denigrate them. But the root of it is that the people who are now in senior positions in our society don't understand that very society. They certainly don't understand, you know, what it is to be a young person in this society. They seem to think that it's still like the 70s when they were young. And it's simply not. I mean, one thing that was said to me, I'll see if I can actually find the original text. It was from a young American guy in his 20s. I can't find it now. But the gist of it was that boomers do not, and let's say people in their 60s and 70s, do not understand that the world is made up of groups which compete against each other. Boomers seem to still have this idea that we're all the same, but we're all individuals, and capitalism is the system by which we communicate with each other and make deals with each other, cooperate, and that's all that's really needed. And of course, in this day and age, that is insane. In a multiracial, multicultural society, that's a recipe for your group getting completely screwed over by other groups. Stefan Molyneux's metaphor would ring very true here about if it's two football teams playing a game of football and one team passes to any player on the passes the ball to any player, but the other team only passes to players in its own team, then that team will win, and the team that passes the ball to anyone will lose. And I think this is basically the position that white people are in today, where they give up everything and think that everyone else will reciprocate. But it's also the situation that we're stuck in because those in charge of our societies do not realize the actual situation on the ground, which is that these other teams are only passing to themselves. I mean, somehow that has eluded them.
Exactly. What they're doing is they're pretending like we live in an individualistic society where everybody's an individual and everybody's playing by the same rules. And that hasn't been true for a very, very long time. We have teams, and team strategies always beat individualist strategies. And we have been hollowed out and taken over by basically parasitic tribal peoples who are, you know, they realized how to hack our system, and now they have a huge amount of power, and they're using their power basically to destroy the majority that created our societies. It's an obvious and horrifying disaster that's ongoing, and we simply have to stop it. Now, I don't know if people 100 years ago in America were this stupid and naive, though. about that kind of stuff. 100 years ago, we had a very, very strong tribalistic immigration restriction movement in America that tried to maintain a white supermajority. in America. And in 1924, they finally got laws passed that were dedicated to maintaining a white supermajority in America. I don't think WASPs 100 years ago were this stupid as they are today. I just don't think they were that stupid, or they wouldn't have put these laws into place, right?
Yeah, I think they got drunk on the Kool-Aid of the hippie movement and rock and roll in the 60s and 70s.
Basically, they, yeah. Well, it took a lot of forms, but definitely they became criminally naive about how the world works. And it's allowed their society to be wrested away from them. And it's being given away. And there's going to be a point where we simply can't get it back. And we're approaching that within a generation or so. And this is why it was so upsetting that Trump turned out to be such a dud. Because I was really thinking early on that this might be an opportunity to turn things around.
It is a real shame. I'm not sure if there's anything left to say about this topic. I think I would just emphasize the point that... the other thing that young American guy said to me was that older people don't understand the nature of power. And power is a very difficult thing to get to grips with. But I think he's right that older people today, what we call boomers, they don't understand that power is something that you don't need to have a specific thing that you would do with it in order to want it. But people will seek it out anyway. That's one thing. But also, if you care about your group, then you will seek power simply in order to benefit your group. And I think that in a highly individualistic and monoracial society, power doesn't really, it's not that important a thing in everyday life, because we all know the situation. It's not going to change much. You'll get vying between religious groups maybe or political groups, but nothing that serious. But in a multiracial society, power suddenly becomes much more important and serious. And I think that, again, because boomers tended to, they grew up in the 60s and 70s and 80s when it simply wasn't that multiracial. So they didn't need to think about power in the way that, for example, a white boy in school today might well be the only white boy in his class at school today, or one of very few. And he will be very aware of power because the black boys are all there together. There are 10 of them, one of him. There are, speaking of the British context, there might be 10 Pakistanis, but only one of him, or only two or three white boys. So, in other words, I think that young white people today have a much more acute awareness of power. And I think that's a huge generational difference that I think is going to really have repercussions over the next few generations. But again, someone like Trump, if he had understood this, I think his presidency would have been drastically different, because he would have been looking to how to maximize power for his group, which he would know existed. Whereas I think for the boomers, that they have the luxury of not believing that their group really exists, or if it does exist, it doesn't matter. And I think that this is a huge difference between the old and the young today, because as we transition into a multicultural, multiracial society, this stuff becomes all more important almost by the day.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. So are there questions that have come in?
Oh, yes. But before we get to that, would you like to talk about COVID at all, or the lockdowns? Because that's the third thing that we mentioned at the start. You're quite, I would say that probably the majority of people in the movement at this point believe that COVID is essentially a con. That there is a virus, but it's not much more dangerous than the seasonal flu. And it's been magnified by the authority, by the powers that be, into something that can be exploited and weaponized and used to justify the Great Reset.
I don't like that narrative. I don't believe that narrative. So, I think the people who run our society, we're certainly not lacking in power. I think the people who run our society, how to put this, they weren't, I don't think this was, first of all, it's a real virus. Second, it's a real pandemic. Third, it's actually worse than the seasonal flu. I think Steve Saylor's most recent piece on this is quite reasonable. And there is this data about excess deaths. We pretty much know, given the age and the number of people in America, how many people should be dying in a given year and in a given period within a given year. And in 2020, we had a lot of excess deaths over what we would normally expect. And in fact, we have a lot more excess deaths than have been attributed to COVID. So if anything, I think the COVID numbers might be too low in the United States. I think it's a very, very serious pandemic. I think that nobody wanted this. I think the idea that people were just rubbing their little hands together thinking, this is how we're going to gain power and get our way, I think this is that's absurd. I think this has thrown a spanner into the works of a lot of people. And it's been utterly catastrophic economically for most of society. So I just don't believe this, this narrative, this kind of conspiracy narrative that floats around in our circles. And I think it makes us all look really dumb. So I'm very, very opposed to all of that. I think it's real. I think it's serious. I do think, however, that the reactions of the establishment have not been evil in the sense of, how to put it, some kind of Machiavellian conspiracy to grab a lot of power, because they have a lot of power. They've got more power than they know what to do with. Okay, I don't think it's that so much as it's a hysterical response, because these people are literally frightened out of their wits and are doing stupid things and oftentimes very, very counterproductive things to stop this. I think that the proper response, if we had a serious country in America or a serious country anywhere in Europe, would have been to do what they did in Taiwan, which is, as soon as news of this thing came out that this was happening in China, stop flights from China. They have had, what, 7 deaths in Taiwan, something like that?
Yes.
They're right next to China, right? Yeah. We've had, what, more than 200,000 in America? This is a disease that penalizes societies that are globalist and liberal, that are massively networked with the global supply chains and global tourism and global travel, and don't have functioning borders and don't have values in place that would allow them to simply close their borders and be xenophobic. So this was almost designed, put it this way, it wasn't designed, but if you were trying to design a virus that would ruin globalist liberal societies, you can't. Well, any virus would do that. That's the trouble, right? Globalist liberal societies are extremely susceptible to viral pandemics like this because they don't have borders and because they depend on other countries to manufacture things like their own medical supplies. Just stupid stuff like that. But why? Because it's a bit cheaper, right? So I think that if we had simply taken the reaction, if we had simply taken the course that a country like Taiwan did, we could have maybe nipped this in the bud. But it was too late. We were paralyzed. We were paralyzed by our greed and by our liberal ideologies. The left was paralyzed by greed. They thought, oh, this is bad for restaurants, and we don't want Chinese restaurants suffering. We don't want Chinese New Year to suffer. We don't want our vacations to suffer. We don't want racism against the Chinese to rear its ugly head. So they argued for open borders and not taking any preventative measures. based on left-wing values. And the people on the right, we're all about, we can't panic the markets. We'll ride this out. We'll just pretend like it's the flu. The flu bro narrative was basically dictated not by any epidemiological findings, but by the desire to do nothing. We don't do anything special every year about the flu. So if we don't want to do anything special about COVID, let's just pretend it's the flu. It's worse than the flu. For one thing, a lot of people are immune to the flu. We have vaccines for the flu. This is a lot worse than the seasonal flu. So anyway, I'm very disappointed with a lot of people in the movement's reaction to this. I think a lot of the anti-vax people are completely batshit crazy, to be perfectly honest. I think a lot of this stuff is deeply unscientific and just clinically paranoid and loony. So I don't know what to do with people like this. You can't really build something, a movement with people whose minds are so credulous and irrational. So it's upsetting. But at this point, I think that we have now jumped, we've gone into a new phase. And I wrote an article early on about this saying, it was called, "I'm Changing My Tune About the Coronavirus." And the article came out, what, back in March or April or something like that? And basically I said, look, there's going to come a point where the coronavirus is going to cease being something new and start being something normal. There's going to be a point where it's part of the new normal, especially in the West, because we didn't take the necessary steps to prevent us from getting saturated with it, right? It's going to be part of the new normal. And at a certain point, people are going to be basically say, look, I want to take my risks. You know, when I drive to the store, I'm risking getting in a car accident. When I take an airplane, I'm risking falling out of the sky. When I mow my lawn, I'm risking getting hit by lightning. Everybody knows there's certain risks associated with life, and they say, I'm willing to take those risks. Get out of my way. I just want to get on with life. People are coming to that point.
This might be where you and I can agree on this matter, yes. Because the coronavirus, as far as I can understand it, has a 99.6% survival rate. Unless you're over 70 or have comorbidities, it's almost certain that you'll survive it. And therefore, I mean, this reaction of having lockdowns and mask wearing and social distancing, it seems completely nuts to me.
Well, I think that a lot of it is now nuts. First of all, the mask thing, okay, I think on a certain common sense level, I apologize, on a common sense level, it just makes sense that if you're not breathing in people's breath and snot and stuff like that, that you're less likely to get sick, right? Oddly enough, though, Asians who are the big mask wearers, most of them don't even believe that germs are the cause of disease. And then we've gotten completely contradictory information from health authorities about masks. So I just don't know what to think about it, to be perfectly honest. And one of the lessons we've learned from COVID is that our authorities have been lying to us for so long that they have basically debauched the public's trust.
Yes.
We don't believe these people anymore. Even when it might be for our own good, we don't believe them anymore. If we're rational, we don't believe them anymore. And that's a very, very bad thing. These are the people who cover up rape gangs, and you know, if they're committed by blacks against whites. These are the people who say that race is a social construct. These are the people who say that diversity is strength. These are the people.
And male and female don't exist.
Yeah, men and women don't exist. That trans women are women. All this nonsense, and then they expect us to believe them about this. When it comes to something really important, a matter of life and death, not them just basically living their dreams and forcing us to go along with their stupid, insane ideologies. When it's something really, really important, they discover that they've lost the public on this. And I think that's just a sad situation that we're in. It's a very, very dangerous situation that they're in, and they're, it's their fault. And again, I know enough about science to be able to, you know, look, vaccination is one of the most well-grounded health measures there is. It's a very old thing. It's based in very sound science. And if vaccination is what some of these nuts say it is, then we have a lot bigger problems than vaccinations. So I do think that we have to, okay, if you can't trust authorities, you just have to trust your own reason on a lot of these things. And a lot of the alternative views that are coming out, and especially circulating around in our realm and getting a lot of credence from people that I otherwise respect, are deeply irrational and often crazy. So in a way, I don't want to even be partisan about this. I just want to step back and say, this is the system's chickens coming home to roost, right? We don't trust science anymore because the people who claim to be scientists are also the ones pushing global warming, right?
Yes.
We have a lot of reasons to be skeptical about this stuff. But that doesn't mean that we should not be skeptical about a lot of these contrary theories that are floating around as well, which are a lot of it's crazy stuff.
Well, yeah, on the matter of the vaccine, this is not a typical vaccine. There was a document that I read, can't remember who it was from now, but they were saying it was like an official government document saying that this is an essentially experimental technology. It's the first RNA vaccine. And yeah, that alone, we don't know what the long-term effects of it are going to be. So this is not a typical thing. It's not like every other vaccine that's been developed. So I think on that basis alone, there is cause for skepticism about the vaccine. Wouldn't you say so?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm certainly not going to be rushing out to take this stuff. I'm going to be waiting for a lot of people to take it before me. And I'm now being told that people of color are going to be the guinea pigs,
be careful what we say here.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I think that they can use all of their black privilege. You know, knock yourselves out, folks. You know, use your black privilege. You can be the guinea pigs. I'm not going to try this stuff until at least 100 million or 200 million guinea pigs have tried it, because it has been rushed out. That's
true. Very much.
It's been rushed out, and it's been massively hyped. But the fact is that if they're not just completely lying about the effectiveness of it, it's actually far more effective than any other normal vaccine. So maybe this is a breakthrough. Maybe this is a breakthrough. And maybe by being skeptical about it, we are in the position of the people who are skeptical about the railroads, right? Or the people who shouted, get a horse, when to the guys driving along in the early motor cars, you know, when the early motor cars broke down. So anyway.
Of course, but the effectiveness of those things was swiftly apparent. I guess
it might be swiftly apparent in this case, and I'm going to wait. I'm going to be one of the people who waits.
Well, that's I can't argue with that. There are lots of people speaking in very animated terms in the chat about this matter, because I'm not trying to denigrate your point of view. I'm just saying that there is, as you've said, a pretty broad consensus in the movement just now that this is essentially a con, a trick. And one of the things was you said that it doesn't benefit global capitalism, but that depends on whether you think that that those at the highest echelons of global capitalism are concerned with spreading the money around, or whether they would rather concentrate it. Because people like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates have made absolute fortunes, and indeed Pfizer
of course, the vaccine people are going to make a lot of money, and the people who are selling stuff that you selling stuff online because you can't go to the store are going to make a lot more money. But the thing is that everybody is going. Somebody always benefits in an economic crisis. You know, pawn shops do extremely well during economic crises. It would not be a rational theory, though, to say that pawn shop owners have somehow engineered an economic crisis just because they're among the people who benefit from it. So there will always be people who can financially benefit from an economic crisis or a pandemic or a war or whatever. It doesn't mean that the people who benefit from it are the ones who have engineered it somehow.
No, but in this case, the people who benefit from it are in a position to have engineered it because they go to Davos, they go to, you know, Bilderberg and so on.
Well, engineered. So what do you mean engineered this?
I don't mean engineered the virus. I mean engineered the response to it. I mean, it has been, with the exception of Sweden and Belarus, this has been a unanimous, I mean, going into lockdowns and so on, and all at the same time within the Western world. And then the same messages, and I've seen think tanks reports about how best to communicate these messages to persuade people to take the vaccine and so on. It's obvious that there's a lot of harmonization, streamlining going on here, globally, about how to persuade people that the virus is real, that it's this dangerous, and that the best thing to do is take the vaccine, and the best thing to do is social distance, and you've got to wear the mask and so on. I think that the world now is so globalized that you could orchestrate this response. I think that you could harmonize this. And it's those at the highest level who would be in the position to do that and who would have incentive to do that because they would benefit from it in all sorts of ways. I mean, at a certain level of society, it's not just about money anymore. It's about designing society itself. It's about having visions for the future. Now, I'm not against that, and I don't think you are either. I'm an elitist. I believe that, you know, we need hierarchy. But Bill Gates is not an elite who I would trust, and neither is Jeff Bezos. Neither is the CEO of Pfizer or many others that you could name. I think that these are the epitome of globalists. They want a world without borders. They want a world where we are just consumers, consume vaccine, get excited for next vaccine. That sounds like a crass thing to say, but I think it is quite accurate of the kind of world that they would like. So I think that they do have incentive to have and ability to have orchestrated this response to it. After the first few weeks where I think it was genuinely chaotic and they were going for, we've got to look after the economy and all that nonsense. And then that was backed up by the left. So the right had, but then after a few weeks, I think that a decision was made. Let's make as much out of this as possible because this is the disaster that we need. This is the crisis that we need in order to bring things forward to, well, what we're now calling the Great Reset.
I don't think the Great Reset is, look, I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's basically, okay, the lesson of COVID is not more globalism, first of all. The things that made us vulnerable to COVID were how globalized the economy was, how open our borders were, how liberal we were. The fact that we have liberal democracies and this happened during an election year. I mean, a lot of the stupidity about America's response to this had everything to do with the fact that it became a political issue, a political hot potato. So I think the lessons of this are anti-globalist, anti-liberal, democratic, etc. Now, of course, there are cynical, megalomaniacal people like Bill Gates and Henry Kissinger and all these other people who are always shilling for globalism. Globalism has caused a pandemic. We need more globalism. That's what they always say. And we do have to mock this and deconstruct their arguments and stop this. But, you know, I don't think that this is, how to put it. I don't think we should construct false narratives that because this pandemic is happening, so this stupid globalist scheme like the Great Reset can happen. I think these people are simply dusting off their same tired old globalist solutions for every problem and shilling like they always do. And in this case, it's remarkably easy to refute what they say because actually the lessons are completely pointing in the opposite direction. Less globalization would actually have saved us. Less liberalism, less liberal democracy would actually have made this better for us. So anyway, I'm not all that worried about that, to be perfectly honest. I just want to get through this thing and get, you know, see life get back to normal. Now, I do think that my initial reaction to the COVID thing, if I were president of the United States, what I would have done is I would have used COVID to grab power. That's what leftists did.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people did. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. my first instinct would be to use it to grab power. So, for instance, leftists used this to let child molesters out of jail and shit like that. Completely insane policies. And then they're going to put people in jail for opening their stores, right? Because it was a death sentence for this child molester to be in jail when COVID is happening, but it's not a death sentence to put this gym owner in jail while COVID is happening. It's completely insane. But anyway,
enables that.
Yeah. Well, what I would have done is I would have used this as a way of grabbing power. So what would you do? Okay, you would find every act that's available to the president, every emergency power, for instance, to order industries to start producing all of our medical supplies in the United States. The president actually has that power. He could do that. The president can close the borders just like that. I would have done that. I would have shut the borders down. I would have immediately mandated that we start producing our own medical supplies in the country, our own masks and ventilators and things like that. Remember, we were in a situation where we were facing a global pandemic and we were finding that there were shortages of things that were necessary. Why? Well, because they were manufactured in China.
It was incredible.
It was incredible. The stupidity of that system. I would have used it to have grabbed a lot of power. Of course, that's not the way Republicans think, right? They want their own little private pleasures and their own little private deals and things like that. They want less power in society. Whereas the left, they always think about how they can gain more power to gain more stuff for their constituency. That's how I think too. And that's what I would have done. And I think that we have to just be brutally pragmatic about COVID going forward. Because what's shaken out here is this. The response has not been mass hysteria to COVID. It's been elite hysteria. I predicted fairly early on that COVID would be something that the elites would start taking very, very seriously. Why? Because it would affect them disproportionately. We know exactly what would have happened if COVID had affected the same people who were dying in the opioid epidemic, right? Nothing. They would have done absolutely nothing about it if it just killed poor white people in flyover country. But this was a pandemic that affects people who travel a lot, people who live in global cities, the most interconnected places, the people who go to concerts a lot,
go
to Davos, go to dinners a lot, press the flesh, go to fundraisers and receptions. This is a disease that especially affects the 1%. And the 1% of the 1%, right? These people are older than average. We live in a gerontocracy. How old is Nancy Pelosi? Almost 80, right? Dianne Feinstein's like 87 years old. These people are old and frail and highly vulnerable. They're always shaking hands, right? They're always meeting people. They're always schmoozing. And this, when they realized that this is coming for them, they panicked. And the reaction that they have is exactly what you predict of an out-of-touch, hysterical, fanatically, fanatically self-absorbed, utterly rich and decadent elite. And so this is going to be populist gold in the future, right? The policies that they have put in place are the exact policies you'd expect of like the Hunger Games elites. And the people who are suffering are ordinary people. The people who don't have millions of dollars and houses in the Hamptons that they can retreat to, you know, all this mask wearing. A lot of it is caught up with virtue signaling. I mean, I was playing with this on Twitter, right? If you're the average shit lib virtue signaler, you fret about this. If you're some awful virtue signaler, you fret about the fact that not everybody is your friend on Facebook, so they can't see your status updates where you signal about your progressive policies. And they can't see the little ribbon that you wear. Not everybody can see that, right? And not everybody's driving behind your Volvo, and so they can't see your bumper stickers. It's just so frustrating. How can you show the entire world, everybody who looks at you, that you're a good person?
Yeah.
Masks. Right? You have the biggest mask smacking on your face. And I thought it was great that Trump made fun of Biden for wearing a mask when he, you know, was alone in the middle of a football field or something like that. why? Because it's a giant virtue signal.
So, the SJW woman that I talked about, that woman who is going like that, she is the kind of person who obsesses about wearing a mask and social distancing and making sure that our kid is social distancing from the other kids. It appeals most to that mentality, I think.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat is saying, why has it killed literally zero celebrities or politicians? Killed Herman Cain, killed Charlie Pride. Those are two people that I can think of recently who have died. One's a politician, one's a celebrity. The brother of Elizabeth Warren died of COVID. There are a lot of people who are dying of this who are actual real people. So don't give us this kind of stuff. I mean, these are embarrassing and shameful talking points to be caring about. It's like actually carrying COVID around. You don't want to do that, or carrying head lice or something. You don't want to spread bad memes. It's just shameful. It's dirty.
Well, of course, there is the other ambiguity there is that a death certificate can say died off COVID when it means died with COVID. That's another thing. I mean, these things, we don't know. For a long time, it seemed like Simon Harris had died of COVID, and that was just an assumption. Turned out that he actually died of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is clearly, again, I do not trust the authorities. I do not trust the media on this. I think that they're distorting it in whatever way they can. Just today, they've gone into Tier 4 in Britain, in southeast England. And the Sky News interviewed a bunch of people, vox pops, on the streets. And every single person said, well, it's not nice, but we're going to have to do it. And I thought, really? Really? Not a single person that you interviewed said, I think this is a load of rubbish. I mean, that's an example of what I mean. I think that they're twisting this in whatever way.
Oh, of course. I'm sure that there are people who probably said this is a lot of rubbish. Definitely somebody said that. But they're not going to be seen out there. I think a lot of the mask wearing and social distancing and lockdowns is basically the ultra rich who are basically just saying we have to keep these proles and their filthy, germy breath away from us. Yeah. That's what's going on here. And it's also a flex. It's a flex because they can afford to just stop working for a year.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's a let them eat cake quality about this that we need to exploit, because in the end, we need to overthrow the entire establishment. They're all bad. Right, left, Democrat, Republican, Labor, conservative. They're all evil and they're all against us. And this is manna from heaven for populists. And we need to start exploiting it. And this is why at a certain point, I'm just going to probably just give up and say, okay, you know, you just take all your crazy anti-vaxxer memes and everything and just run with it, folks.
Burn, baby, burn,
you know?
It sounds like at a certain point, the disagreement over whether, you know, how deadly COVID is actually ceases to matter, because it's very clear that no matter how deadly it is, the governments and the powers that be's response to it has been terrible. And so
it's been terrible.
We can agree on that.
Yeah, there's been no question about that. Also, it's very interesting if you look at, you know, what people think is going on versus what's actually going on. People think it's actually a lot worse than it is. And I have to say that that has to be based on just hysterical reporting in the media. The mainstream media is giving normies who depend on the mainstream media for their information a very, very panic-inducing and distorted picture of how bad this is, which isn't to say that it's not bad. It's actually quite bad. It's the second worst pandemic in U.S. history after the Spanish influenza now. It's pretty damn bad. But there are people out there who literally think it's far, far worse than that. And these people are being gaslighted. And it's extremely irresponsible on the part of the media and a part of the establishment to basically allow this kind of hysteria and gaslighting to take place. But again, I think the hysteria is coming from the top. This is the hysteria generated by our corrupt and crazed elites who are deathly afraid of this because, well, they're in the highly vulnerable category. Again, they're old, and a lot of them are, you know, they live in global cities. They used to be flying everywhere. They used to be going to lots of concerts and eating in restaurants and going to receptions and stuff like that. This really goes for the highly connected people. It's very interesting. The people with the greatest social connectivity in America are Jews. Their social networks are, you know, depending on what ethnic group you belong to, and what Jewish group you belong to, I've seen numbers that Jews have like 10 times the social network connectivity of the average white person. And you see the resistance of Orthodox Jews in the United States to any kind of COVID measures. These people are super spreaders, right?
Well, New York City was a hotspot for deaths of COVID at the start.
Yeah, yeah. And so, again, when you look at our elites tend to be highly socially networked people. And the more socially networked you are, the more vulnerable you are. So you can see why I think a kind of hysteria took over. It's elite hysteria, not mass hysteria. And the masses are suffering terribly from this. But I, at this point, I don't think lockdowns matter. Basically, what's happened is this, okay? The stupid idiots who run our society, the Republicans who want open borders and free trade, and the left who wants open borders and free flow of people, even if they're just parasites, right? They put us in a situation where all of our countries, especially the Western European countries, got this infection going. And it's not going to go away. It's not going to stop.
No, people find ways to keep it going. I mean, they've just announced that there's a new variant of coronavirus in England. So, I mean, you know, and there'll be a second wave and a third wave and all the rest of it.
It's It's not going to stop. And at this point, you know, quarantining international air travelers and things like that, it doesn't make any sense. Why should we have limits on international air travel now? Because it's in every Western country. It doesn't make any sense at this point. Yeah. And so these policies don't make any sense. The only policies that would really make sense would be to lock up all the old people. You're right. Yes. You know, lock up every old and vulnerable person. Basically lock up our ruling elites. You know, and throw away the key, right? You
know? Start with the boomer Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the people who need to be locked down. The rest of society doesn't need to be locked down. Yet we're not going to see that happening. Why? Well, because they're the ones who are doing it to us, right? It's the old and vulnerable who are calling the shots, and they are not going to lock themselves away. They're going to lock us away.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think they're pretending to be scared about it. I mean,
they are very scared. You know,
politicians laughing about it when their mics are secretly on. You see the news readers having maskless birthday parties. That's happened in Britain recently. But meantime, they behave as if, you know, they speak as if it's a dreadful thing, and they definitely want the public to be as scared as possible. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Maybe you're right that they are secretly very scared about it. But I don't know. I think it's a performance. Somebody pointed out just on the matter of, because you were saying about New York and the Jews being very socially mobile, somebody pointed out that this new Tier 4 and the heightening of all lockdown restrictions in Britain, that was announced the very day after Hanukkah was over.
That's truly hilarious.
Yeah, it certainly is. So, you know, we're going to go without a nice Christmas, but at least they got Hanukkah.
They got their Hanukkah in, yeah.
All right.
Well, I kind of hope that it really is that that contagious when you see things like that. When you see things like Gavin Newsom at the most expensive restaurant in California, all huddled together with his big donors and his wife and people like that, not social distancing. I was sitting there thinking, you know, I really hope this is as dangerous as it's supposed to be, because it really could get rid of our elites. It really could just clean house. Right. And all those people who hate boomers, you know, they must be salivating over this stuff.
I don't hate boomers that much. I'm just annoyed at their naivety sometimes. Yeah. I want to emphasize, I don't hate boomers. And I know that millennials are just as bloody bad in their own way. So anyway, let's move on to the super chats.
Sure.
It's been a very interesting discussion. I think we should quit while we're on top. So, okay. So to speak. All right. So, Greg, we don't know, and this is from One Man's Chorus, who I think you know off this. Greg, we don't know if lockdowns curb the spread of the virus, because the evidence on that is inconclusive. But we do know that lockdowns have adverse effects on mental health. Do you think the point of lockdowns is to make everyone despair so that they will take the vaccines?
No, I don't think so. I do think, though, that, and this is one example of how crazy these policies are, is that nobody seemed to take into account the negative effects of the lockdowns on people's health, or not making it possible for people to seek medical attention. Right. A lot of people died of things that could have been prevented because we had this idea that nobody must go to the hospital. We have to wait till the COVID people come.
It's so appalling.
It's appalling. It's appalling, and it's incredibly stupid. And I think what's going on here is just stupidity, and that you're giving them too much credit, basically.
Okay.
We don't want to give our leaders too much credit. We should always basically, I think, favor stupidity versus malice and Machiavellianism as an explanation, especially when a lot of this stuff just doesn't make sense, even from a Machiavellian point of view. I think you're just giving them too much credit.
Okay. I mean, I would certainly agree with that regarding politicians. I think the politicians are quite visibly stupid on both sides of the Atlantic. It's quite incredible. Okay. Merry Christmas, Greg and Bose. Question on epistemology. In The Great Reset, Klaus Schwab writes, it could be inferred from quantum physics that objective reality does not exist.
This is why I don't take this stuff seriously. This is just, this is insanity. Go ahead.
Reminds me of Semiogog's stream last night, which everyone should watch, by the way. It was very good. I'll start again. Question on epistemology. In The Great Reset, Klaus Schwab writes, it could be inferred from quantum physics that objective reality does not exist. Is this true? And if so, what does it mean for us that globalist thinkers do not believe in objective truth?
Well, I don't honestly know what the argument is that, or how anyone can argue that quantum physics leads to the view that objective reality doesn't exist. It's alarming that you do have people in positions of power who will say stupid things like objective reality doesn't exist, which is basically their excuse for doing something that doesn't make any sense. Right. You only want to go to complete metaphysical nihilism if you're about to do something that makes no sense within the context of the real world or common sense.
Okay. I'll move on because I've just realized that I've actually got the next stream starting in 12 minutes. So
good
I will
Lord,
have to.
Yeah.
This one's really gone very quickly. Hi, Woz and Greg. No pressure, Greg, but it would be nice to see your face during live streams.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
Okay, all right. Quick answer. All right. Thank you both for what you do. Dr. Johnson, what is your opinion on Alex Duggan's political philosophy and the Eurasian Party?
Well, I've written a piece. Excuse me. I might have the holocough coming on. I've written a piece on
6% of chance of surviving it, so don't worry too much.
Yeah, that's true. Alexander Dugin, I'm not crazy about his ideas, to be perfectly honest, and I wrote a piece at Countercurrents called North Americanism, a Cautionary Tale, which is basically a satire of Dugin. So just go to the Countercurrents website and type in North Americanism and look at that, and then follow the links at the bottom, the tags for Dugin. There's a lot of stuff about Dugin at Countercurrents that's mostly very critical of him.
Okay. Well, and the final, it isn't so much, it's not a question at all. It's just a compliment that I thought would be nice to end the stream with. Greg Johnson is a hero. I always love listening to Greg. His thoughts are so cogent and sincere. He's an all-round great dude.
Well, I appreciate that, and I agree. No, but seriously, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, yeah, I should echo that. I mean, Greg has been very, very kind to me this year, and very patient with me this year. So he is a great dude. And I'm very glad to have had him on Millennial again. So, I mean, he's obviously a staple on Millennial. So, let's end it at that, Greg. Thank you very much for taking part in Millennial 2020.
Well, thank you for having me on, and Merry Christmas, everyone out there. I know this is going to be a very hard Christmas for a lot of people. I can't spend it with my family. People that I know are isolated from one another. And that's why I think Millennial is so important this year more than ever, because we're all sort of forced to have fellowship any way we can to get it. And getting it this way, I think, is one of the best things that Woz here is doing for our community. And he's doing a whole year's worth of live streaming in a couple of weeks' time. It's a remarkable achievement. And so if you're just a free rider on his work, I really suggest that you, well, in the spirit of Christmas, right, chip in, help out financially to keep things like this going, because I think it's extremely valuable. So thanks again, and Merry Christmas, everyone, and good night.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll just put the donation link in since it's become relevant suddenly.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I would indeed appreciate donations. That's the first time I've said that, though, in millennials, so I don't feel bad about saying it. But yes, that would be nice. Okay, well, excellent. Next up is Josh Neal in about 10 minutes. So I'll see you then. In the meantime, thank you, Greg, and thank you to everyone for watching. I hope you enjoyed this one. Okay, I'll see you later. Bye for now.